Welcome to this week's edition of Two Men in the Middle, Three Men in the Middle this week, where three men discuss politics, current events from the center of the country. I'm Brandon Koenig.
I'm Craig Healy.
And I'm Jason Peterson.
So, guys, I'm going to open today. I want to talk first and foremost about Biden's announcement withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. Now, Trump had made the announcement that he had planned to withdraw by May. So Biden is extending that timeline for kind of a more thorough and disciplined rollout by September 11, a date that carries a lot of symbolism. And of course, that's resulted in a lot of discussion and kind of back and forth on should we completely withdraw from Afghanistan? Should we leave some troops there? This has been a 20-year war. It has eclipsed all other conflicts that we've been involved in the 20th century. So what is your take on the announcement from the administration? Right decision, wrong decision?
Jason, you sent the text with the most information on this, so I'm going to let you answer that one.
I don't know if it was the most information or the most questions, but I do find this very fascinating. I think we've proven as a nation we're not very good at nation building, which is sort of what this seems to have turned into, or at least the attempt to turn it into. I think if you want to call the war in Afghanistan a war to prevent it being used as a basis of terrorism and to find Osama bin Laden, both of those goals were accomplished many, many, many years ago. You could even argue that the insurgency component and the base for terrorism was solved within 6 months. Obviously, it took almost 10 years, I think, to find bin Laden. But the last 10 years, I can't make a good concrete argument for why we're there, because it was never explained, I think, well to the public what the criteria for success was and what the criteria to exit was. So I'm not surprised to hear this. It seemed like the news didn't stick very well last year when Trump announced the same thing. So I'd be curious from you guys, like what the difference in announcement and analysis from the pundits has been between the two events. There's my first piece.
So I would say that from a political point of view, it's interesting. I think when Trump made the announcement, Republican criticism was muted more so because it was a Republican president, and we've seen more vocal Republican criticism now because we have a Democratic president. So there's the politics of it, but both have announced a date, and so I think something that I have an issue with is announcing a date of withdrawal, in advance, because I think that provides an opportunity for just bad things to happen on the ground and in the field. While our troops are still there and make some targets more so than they should. As far as the decision itself, I have no qualms with it. Politically speaking, it's a good decision because support for remaining over there is at an all-time low. Most Americans favor having us withdraw troops from Afghanistan and have for some time now. And getting back to what you were saying, Jason, the Bush administration, when we originally went into Afghanistan, the original statements for going in that were given were not to remain there. It was to conduct a shock and awe campaign where we would take out the central operations of the Taliban and of Al Qaeda operating there. We would make it unusable, and then that was it. So we did accomplish that. Within the first couple of months, and then it did become a nation building exercise. And so you had this battle within the Bush administration, if you can recall, back at the time, between the neoconservatives that were serving on the National Security Council and the foreign policy realists. Neoconservatives said, no, we need to, spread democracy, make this a, democratic cause celeb in the Middle East, and it can have the potential to have ramifications. And you had others that said, no, this isn't going to work, because look at history. Look at what the Russians did. The neoconservatives won the argument, and so hence we are still there today. And it's interesting because past administrations, the Obama administration was never able politically to find a way to completely withdraw out of Afghanistan. So that was something they weren't able to make good at on. Trump came in under this populist banner, kind of reverting back to kind of just domestic focus and no foreign entanglements. And so that really played into his strength. And I think, Biden, I think, will have some pushback, but not as much, because I think we're at a point now, 20 years, where people are wary and just tired. I mean, fatigue has set in, and most Americans don't want to be over there any longer.
You mentioned a surge under Bush. There was a surge under Obama too, right? I think as recently as 2010, we had like 100,000.
There was, yeah, there. There was a surge under President Obama.
So
as well.
It is significantly fewer troops now to presumably maintain the peace.
I think right now we have about 3,000 troops in Afghanistan. I think last year the combat deaths were one. Where I think there were two total deaths, one by combat, one by accident. So for the most part, combat operations have stopped in Afghanistan. One point that you said, Brandon, the idea of nation building in Afghanistan is ridiculous. It's never going to work. You can look at the history of that Afghanistan specifically in that area of the world. The United States military, we're not good nation builders to begin with. No. That's really not core to our mission, but it really was never going to work in Afghanistan.
And if you look back, Afghanistan going way, way back was under British control when the British colonized it before the Russians even. No colonizing force has ever been able to create a central government there. And that's part and parcel because of the terrain, but also because of the mix of ethnic groups that comprise Afghanistan. And
they don't want to be a centralized democracy.
Right.
They have no desire to do that.
And I mean, you have Sunni, you have Shiite, you have the Kurds, you have these distinct groups. And the problem is now, 20 years later, despite everything we've done, the only stability there is really in the capital, in Kabul. And when you get outside of the capital region, it's pretty much anarchy. I mean, there's no stability. And so long term, I think that's what you can expect out of that region.
That instability.
Well, Jason, what's your definition of when it would be time for the United States to leave Afghanistan?
Well, that's a good question. Part of it is framing what is the nature of the conflict? We keep calling this the war in Afghanistan. Is it a war if we have 3,000 troops committed?
And a war for what?
Right. I do wonder if sometimes it's the language that our government used and how we communicated the effort. If it's no longer a war and it's a hold Kabul for the ability to support a government and to ensure women's rights and to ensure some form of education for kids, maybe that's a different context that Americans evaluate the success criteria.
So what I heard you just say, if the government would announce that we are ending military operations in Afghanistan, but our nation-building force, or our just let's make sure women aren't killed force, whatever name you want to give it, that's staying there on a humanitarian mission. That would be at least be something everybody could understand of why we needed to keep people there.
Well, we never reframed the mission.
Yeah.
It's always been a war on terror and a war in Afghanistan. And, you know, when does that part end? When does the fighting stop?
Yeah.
Or does it not? In which case, then maybe we shouldn't have been there.
Well, and there's a couple of points. If after 20 years, if safeguarding democratic voting rights and women's rights and rights of minorities, if that cannot be maintained without our presence, then we've accomplished very little, right? Because that tells us that the infrastructure that we've attempted to build there is too shaky. And is it?
Yeah.
So, you know, number one, I think the Afghans need to be able to provide that themselves, or we need to let NGOs or United Nations peacekeeping forces step in to handle that, because that's really what they're equipped to do. Our military does a fantastic job of that, but that's not really their core responsibility. And it's really kind of unfair to ask our U.S. military men and women to do all of that as well as keep the peace. Yeah. I mean, it's layering all these responsibilities on them when that's not really their central mission and objective.
There's a parallel here to policing. We don't need to get into that right now. We train warriors to be warriors, to take over, to kill, to destroy, to defend, whatever, not to go raise kids in an educational setting, improve hospitals, and provide women's rights. That's just a totally different.
And we're certainly not trained to build a democracy out of a section of the world that doesn't want a democracy. I think this is part of the error of our ways sometimes, is we're going to nation build. We're going to build some sort of American version of democracy in Afghanistan because that's how you get to maximum freedom. And the way
Well, we've learned that you can't build that from scratch, right? You have to have the foundation there, and the principles have to exist for that to flourish. And so there's a real question that whether that exists in Afghanistan. I would argue it doesn't. The history in that country shows that there's no foundation there to retain that based on just the ethnic conflicts and the lack of any centralizing force that unifies the country. There is no centralizing unifying force within that country? None that they can rally around. And so in the absence of that, how do you keep it together as a country? So this reminds me, if you go back many years ago, I think it was maybe when Biden was running for president in 2008 during the Democratic nomination, he was mocked and criticized for putting forward that Afghanistan should be divided into three separate countries. Do you remember that on ethnic lines?
And he should. But they should.
But they should. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think if you look back now over 20 years, Biden was right, because I don't think that can be maintained as a country, a single unit. It just can't.
Another brief part of the evaluation here should be what the actual threats are to the United States. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of threat to the United States from there anymore. The threat actors have moved now.
Right.
You know, it's whether it's election meddling or cyber terrorism or, bots falling from the sky. I mean, there's a lot of advanced technology and economic and political manipulation that can be done to the country that maybe isn't, the Mujahideen in the middle of the mountains.
Yeah. Right. I hate this. I mean, the threat of like global Islamist-based terrorism has subsided quite a bit. So I feel like I should say that, knock on wood, because it could, rise again any time. Now, we did go through a period where that threat level was very high and there were smaller scale terrorist incidents throughout the world that happened, Western targets. And so there was an argument to be able to provide a buffer on the ground to that threat. But you're right. I mean, that has moved for the most part. And there's probably more of an argument to be made about if you were going to have a true presence anywhere, having it in Syria, where there is active and known intelligence of extremist forces using Syria as a base, mm-hmm. More so than Afghanistan. But yeah, I think that threat has moved. But I think we also have to be aware that threat can reemerge and come back at any time. And so it's not there presently, but again, we can't just wait for it either. I think we need to be nimble. We need to get out while we can. And then we also have to have the ability to be smart enough to be able to move and address threats wherever they are. And right now, as long as we have 3,000 troops there, that's 3,000 troops we can't have elsewhere if we need to deploy them rapidly. And we can't forget that we have China and Russia, which are rising geopolitical threats, state actors instead of non-state actors, more of a threat than ever that we need to be aware of.
Well said.
I think I heard you two just say something. I want to make sure maybe this is what I heard. So 20 years ago, Islamic terrorists attacked the United States. In response, we dispersed troops really all over the world to fight this terrorism threat. 20 years later, as a result of that terror event, now domestic terrorism is the number one threat. Islamic terrorism is on the decline and we're pulling out. I guess what just struck me there is from 9/11 to 20 years forward, Islamic terrorists isn't the threat. We've become our own biggest threat. Isn't that exactly what they were after on 9/11? Isn't that exactly what they were trying to do? We're pulling out of Afghanistan, which will deteriorate into a shit show like it always does, because that's just Afghanistan. And we're pulling out to rejigger our forces to deal with other foreign powers like China and Russia and a growing internal threat.
Well, yes. And if you remember Osama bin Laden himself, like his rationale for forming Al-Qaeda and for fighting against the West was American presence in Saudi Arabia, which he saw as sacrilegious because of Saudi Arabia being the home of to Mecca and Medina and the holy sites of Islam. He saw that as a threat, and that's why he came to power and instigated global terrorism. So our presence around the world was what incited him to act. And so us withdrawing is actually the response in many cases that he wanted.
How much of 9/11 is in January 6th? How much of what happened on 9/11 put us on a course
I mean, there's so many parallels. Yeah. I mean, it's your trait. Yeah. It's one form of extremism for another. And I mean, they both share commonalities in terms of how people are radicalized. Yeah. And
the subtext of all this is fear. And if one of the goals of terrorism is to create fear, look at what the impact and the ripple through two decades was to the United States. I mean, we still operate out of fear in so many ways, and certainly the response from legislation and militarily and how we approach the rest of the world was influenced by that.
And you just said the word radicalized, Brandon. So is it fair to say, or is there a truth of fairness to say that the radicalization that started with the United States following 9/11 came to fruition January 6th? That those two events are related to each other.
And they are. And the origin of that radicalization of both forms of the radical Islamist terrorism as well as the domestic terrorism was the internet and the spread and the recruitment of followers online. The internet was the conduit that was utilized to radicalize people and to recruit them. In both cases.
It's another sign of how much technology and the nature of war has changed in the last 20 years. And to your point about having a nimble military that can maybe move out of here and move into other threat areas, that is – We learned here how important special forces are, how important surgical strikes are, how important satellite views and tracking are. Like, these are the kinds of things that could allow us to be more nimble if terrorism or terror cell-like areas reoccur in smaller areas.
Right.
Going
we forward. Don't need necessarily as many troops physically on the ground.
You
as
need
long
100,000
as we have this
people deployed to a non-state location.
Right. Yeah.
Or do we still need Trident-class nuclear submarines to patrol the oceans to do what? Do we still need all the Abrams tanks they build in Cleveland and park in a lot?
And the expense associated with them? Yeah. Because you're talking about billions and billions of dollars.
20 years after 9/11, we are still plowing hundreds of billions of dollars into legacy weapon systems for the military that the military doesn't even want.
Right.
That's part of the legacy of that attack.
Well, that's a whole nother topic, because that, so much of that expense isn't even questioned. It's just it's signed off on.
Sure.
And we don't even say, hey, do we really need this? I mean, shouldn't we scrutinize this? We have a tendency in this country to not scrutinize the military expenditures, even though it would do us well.
I'd like to hear some of the rationale behind tanks. That's a good example. But air superiority still matters. And, you know, from your point on nuclear submarines, there's so much that's a deterrent effect from there that I think that still applies. But fighting
a
giant land
who?
War with tanks and 100,000 troops to India,
China,
Russia, anybody that's nuclear armed.
True,
right?
True. That's true. I just have a hard time finding who is our enemy right now that we would need a submarine to deter. Or who's deterred by the tens of thousands of tanks we have parked in Cleveland?
The reason it's a deterrence is because if a surprise attack is launched and it takes out all of your land-based missile silos, you still have these things hidden underneath the ocean that can pop up and return fire.
So Jason and I were talking about murder robots before you got here.
Okay.
In the context of
– like drones that kill?
Yes.
Like
Jason's found some videos of some murder robots that are pretty cool. But I think what
– Define cool but scary, yes.
Yeah.
What we were trying to say is, wait a minute. With all of this military technology, isn't the first country that invents the murder robot wins? I mean, it's not going to come down to subs and tanks and stuff like that. It's going to come down to advanced AI weapon systems and whoever can integrate that into their military the quickest and the most effective.
Yeah, I would think so. But hasn't there been a reluctance to utilize that? I know it was first used during the Obama administration to target.
Do you think the Chinese would have a reluctance in using that?
Not at all.
Probably not.
Yeah.
You want to get dark? What about a super bug, a pathogen that's deployed somewhere that your army's already inoculated against?
While you're over there building tanks, maybe somebody's building biological weapons.
Well, and let's not forget too, China has that lab in Wuhan, and they have been known to work on.
We're kind of familiar with that one,
right?
Brandon.
Just a little bit over the last year. Yeah. So you know, I think that there's a lot of ways that could be utilized to terrorize and target.
But I do think this comes back to, regardless of the analysis on the right or left on the success of the war in Afghanistan and how our exit from there looks, it does hint to we have a lot of threats. The threats are spread around. They're numerous. They're very different than they were 20 years ago. And our military and our government's budget towards that needs to be reallocated.
Agreed. And we have to address the diminished threats like in Afghanistan and withdraw those troops so that we can respond elsewhere when needed and respond quickly.
So I heard Liz Cheney give an interview with Neil Cavuto on this on Fox. And the first thing is that, you know, Liz Cheney is very traditional conservative in how she looks at the military.
Right.
And of course, Liz Cheney thinks we should stay. But Liz Cheney makes the good faith argument of what happens when we leave. We've talked about, you know, our influence around the world, and everybody kind of agrees it's a better when America is engaged. And she laid out an argument to stay in Afghanistan that was based off her study, her intellect, and her experience. And it was a good faith argument. And if we chose to stay in Afghanistan, I don't think that's right, but I could live with that. There's reasons for it. And the first thing it made me think of is if the Republican Party were all Liz Cheney, we could get back to governing. Because right. Liz Cheney has –
because it's based on ideas,
at least. Debate.
She has an ideology that doesn't change every 24 hours. You right. know where she's coming from. She reads. She thinks. She intellectualizes things. She has an agenda, as all politics do – or politicians do, but her agenda isn't building likes and a brand on social media.
Yeah.
So in some ways, while it's like, well, there's Liz Cheney, warmonger again, just saying we should stay everywhere, it was a point to recognize – yes, she does have a legitimate conservative position, and wouldn't it be nice if we had more people across the politics spectrum who had an ideology that didn't change and could make an argument and we could engage in a debate other than what we're doing now?
Right. Unfortunately, she's an outlier now. Which
she's a complete outlier.
Sad, yeah. I agree. I think that it would be great to be able to have these discussions. The last 4 years, we couldn't have these types of reasonable discussions because the Trump administration policy was disengage from the world completely, and not just when it came to like the threats against us, but to working internationally on a whole host of issues, whether it be climate change. It was just disengagement, focused solely on our own backyard. We don't need the rest of the world. It was that type of mentality. And so it's very difficult to have robust intellectual debates when that's basically a debate stopper.
Is anybody in the world helping us in Afghanistan anymore, Brandon, or are we just there by ourselves?
I think now we're just there by ourselves. I know originally we had, I mean, more than 50 nations there on the ground with us, but I think slowly over time, most of those countries have withdrawn troops. Maybe the Brits have a few
so
troops.
So do the
left.
Australians. I saw a little bit of that. There's still
Brits
a small
and Australians,
NATO presence because
yeah.
they also announced they'd be leaving at the same time. If former President Trump announced that we were going to start leaving in May, and now it's been somewhat delayed. Do you see that this is a chance that it gets delayed again? Do you think we really will be out by September 11th? And what would be the cause of another delay?
I think we'll be almost all out by 9/11. I think they will leave some sort of special forces, rapid force presence for something. But for all practical purposes, I think we'll be out by September. I think this is it. You don't set the date as 9/11 and then back
it.
Off on that.
Right.
That's not
I mean,
the way to
there's
do it.
So much intentional symbolism there.
Yes.
And so I think we will stick to it. And I think, again, for extending the date past May, I think that provides more time as well for preparation and, allows all those boxes to be checked. But it also gives time, too, for like global peacekeepers to come in. I mean, I really think there's a role for having like NGOs to step in and fill the void when it comes to education, when it comes to women's rights.
Defined NGO for everybody.
Non-governmental organizations. Gotcha. So those are organizations.
By everybody, I meant me because I didn't understand what that meant either. So.
Like the Red Cross and Amnesty International and UN peacekeeping forces. Like so any organization that works across state boundaries, geopolitical boundaries that has a nonprofit mission, basically.
Imagine the logistics of leaving there. Over 20 years, how many military bases did we build? How much equipment did we build there? How much technology was invested in that place? Is it pulled out? Is it left for somebody else to use?
Have you seen, I think it's on HBO, but there's a documentary of just how much equipment is just lying around Afghanistan. How much of that we've just parked and just left. And it'll never leave.
Yeah, some of it has
it'll
been
just
lost.
Sit there and deteriorate.
Yeah,
or stolen.
Yeah.
So there's a reason why Afghanistan is known as the place empires go to die. Russia showed it to us in the 80s.
The British.
We just jumped in it. After 20 years, it's just time to go. And yes, is Afghanistan – are you going to turn on CNN after September 11th and see horrible shit happening in Afghanistan? I would say the odds of that are probably 100%.
Yeah.
But at some point, we just have to decide. Where Liz Cheney is wrong, it's not that you need to state a clear objective before you get into a war. I agree with that. But the real question to ask is, can that objective be achieved?
Yes.
Right. And once that question is no, it's time to go home.
Yep.
And I don't see any other way you can spin it to that.
No, and I mean, again, we should have learned that lesson throughout history, right? I mean, Vietnam, Cuba. I mean, you can go back through America's history of conflicts and empire building.
About every conflict since World War II.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think I said this off mic, but there's that the phrase the Afghans use is "You have the watch, I have the time, and we can wait. Eventually, you'll leave." They all leave. Eventually, the British, the right, anybody that's gone there eventually has tucked their tail between their legs and left.
Yeah.
And the Afghan people know that. And again, we're talking the people that are running the Afghan military now, they fought the Russians in the 80s when they were teenagers. This is a civilization that generation to generation grows up on war. It's part of their day. They're not appalled by it so much as we are because they've lived with it for so long. So I think I come down on this. Yeah, it's just time to pull the plug. It's time to move on. If something flares up, we can send one of these fancy drones or something we have over to do something. But boots on the ground in Afghanistan, that's never a good idea.
Yeah, I think we've learned that. So perhaps we shift topics now, going from kind of foreign entanglements to domestic.
Uh-oh, Jason's checking time. He's become the new Mike.
Just making sure we're staying on pace.
We got to have Mike on a pod soon because I've been making fun of Mike on the microphones a lot lately. We have to give him a chance.
Oh, yeah.
To
he needs himself. To respond. Exactly.
Yeah.
So other news this week, we learned that a couple of members of the House, some of the MAGA adherents of Trump, are forming their own caucus called the America First Caucus. They've outlined the precepts of that caucus in a declaration, so to speak, and what their intent is. And it's pretty clear that most of the members of Congress who are rallying behind this, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and Paul Gosar of Arizona and Louis Gohmert, these are personalities. These are people who have no legislative accomplishments. They are not movers and shakers. They are not intellectuals. They are not policy wonks. They are brand focused, but they all do share one thing in common, and that is a love of Trump and carrying on his legacy, whatever that is. And so they've outlined what they think that is. And what's interesting is that they believe that it's a focus solely on America. It's shutting out immigrants. It's returning to our quote unquote Anglo-Saxon roots. So it's very nativist, very xenophobic. And it really kind of speaks to, I think, kind of the Tucker Carlson wing right now of the party and where it's headed.
Hey, Jason, what's our Anglo-Saxon roots mean? I'm confused about what they're talking about.
Read it as white.
That's how I took it.
So
European.
That's what it is. And I'm surprised they actually included that. I guess I was shocked that there was nothing really subtle about it. I expected some of the subtlety that you would typically get.
Oh, I think you're giving these people way too much credit.
That may be.
I mean, with the list of folks that you just listed off, there's not a ton of intellectual firepower in this group. But you have to give a tip of the cap to them in that these are folks who are not interested in legislation. They are not interested in getting anything done.
So this is for a media cycle? This is for fundraising?
They're there to brand build. They're there to fundraise. They're there to give angry speeches about stuff.
And you said fundraise. This provides a platform for expanded fundraising because now that you have a caucus, you can create PACs tied to that caucus. You can fundraise even more. And then that money flows to each of them individually for their campaigns. Even though Marjorie Taylor Greene raised, I think, over $3 million this last quarter, I'm sure she'll raise more now with this news. And so you have to also keep in mind that everything comes down to fundraising because fundraising allows the brand building to continue.
I don't think we mentioned the name of this. This is the America First Caucus.
Yeah.
And do they have legislative goals or has that not been announced yet?
I don't think that. Yeah, I did not see that. That was maybe announced.
Yeah. It never will be announced.
I mean, it sounds for the most part like it's obstructionist, right? There's everything that they want to stop and prevent, and so it makes sense that they wouldn't have legislative goals, right? They want to block the existing administration and existing majority in Congress from passing.
That's the greatest thing about this group of people we're talking about. You don't have to really know anything or do anything to be impactive.
Right.
You don't have to come to Congress and say, I'm here for this progressive legislation. I'm just here to brand build, fundraise, and get my name out.
So does this create enough noise and enough attention that it causes some lingering middle ground Republican Party to step up and get out of the shadow of this? Or is this just another, you know what, this will take the headlines for a week and we move on?
Maybe we shouldn't read too much into this. Maybe this the audience for who this caucus was created for is one, and that's Donald Trump. And this is the same group of folks that just keep going on and on, trying anything to get Trump's attention. Maybe this is just one more attempt to brand something that Trump branded as a way to keep him close, that if he gets into 2024, they can coattail him again.
Right. It'd be because, again, these are all members of the House that are going to be up for re-election in 2 years. And so they want to be able to keep that tie into Trump as much as possible. And, you know, I think what you alluded to, Craig, I mean, these are not the brightest bulbs. I mean, these are fairly dumb members of Congress.
Yeah.
So there was no dog whistling. But one of the other things that was—
Other than Anglo-Saxon.
Anglo-Saxon. Well, but again, I don't even think that was really dog whistling. I mean, to me, that's why I was surprised they included that.
Do you think they're so dumb they don't know what message that is that they're sending?
I think that's part of it. Because they also said, you know, the line from many on the far right who want to dog whistle and be careful is saying, well, I'm not against legal immigration. I'm just against illegal. They said, no, we want to suspend all immigration to the United States. If you caught that in the declaration, they said suspend all immigration, both legal and illegal, which takes them, I mean, that's like going back to like the anti-immigrant policies of the 20s and 30s, which is really interesting. You know, you go back to that. But they also, I thought what was also interesting is that they called for construction of roads, bridges, and buildings to reflect the architecture and engineering and aesthetic value that befits the progeny of European architecture. So it's like...
That seems another blatant shot across the bow there in the culture wars.
What do you think they mean by that? Huh.
Well, and again, if you recall, this dovetails with what Trump was attempting to do behind the scenes while he was president, rewriting contracts for federal architecture so that it reflected kind of classic and federal style. And so there was no modernist elements, you know. So, and again, that was Trump kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, get back to who we were, return to how America used to be, make America great again.
So this is a non-serious group of people creating a non-serious group. But at the same time, all it takes is one endorsement from Trump, and suddenly we have to take this group very, very seriously.
And that's why I think you have people like Adam Kinzinger, who's somebody I admire, who's from one of the few remaining people left in the wing of the Republican Party that's traditional and kind of anti-Trump. And he's actually called for anybody who joins his caucus to be stripped of their committee assignments. And so there has been – it has sparked a lot of outrage because they have been so – clearer in what they stand for. There's been no ambiguity. And that's right, because I think Trump lends them credibility. They're able to kind of gain a foothold. And again, it creates more problems because the Republicans aren't able to move forward with a governing agenda as long as they have this as a distraction that's getting attention.
Yeah, but the Republicans are never going to put forth a legislative agenda.
I caught that too.
That's just not what they do. They could care less. I'm fascinated with this group because, one, it's a brand building exercise by a group of just low level trolls in Congress. I say it all the time. Louie Gohmert's the stupidest person in Congress.
They're low level trolls, they have a lot of money, and with a lot of money comes the ability to exert power and influence, especially in the media and across social media.
And they're playing to this. They're playing to the person who is the gravitational center of the Republican Party still, right, which is Trump. And if they can pull him into the orbit, suddenly that lends legitimacy to this group.
And then you wonder if they're able to pull him in, because McCarthy had issued a statement on this group, you know, basically not condemning them, but saying the Republican Party doesn't stand for this type of, you know, anti blah, blah, blah. Mm. But if Trump gets behind this group, you're going to see criticism of him muted, right? You're going to see McCarthy then probably slide back on his criticism, and it creates a lot of issues. And that's what we've seen over the last couple of months, right? So you've had all these Republicans go kiss Trump's ring, and you've had people like Nikki Haley who've gone back and forth every position imaginable on Trump's behavior. And so every time Trump gets himself involved like this, you start to see Republicans revert and retract what they initially said. And so it creates a lot of problems. Well,
the other danger here is this formation of this sort of caucus allows for downstream candidate selection and rallying, right? So at some point they could be trying to influence local elections at the state or city level.
Very good point.
You get enough of them, and now it isn't just the five crazies, right?
So Jason, you and I texted a little bit this week, and I think one of us broke out the line that conservative intellectuals, when you listen to them, wow, they make a lot of sense. And they are really – it's really easy to listen to folks like Jonah Goldberg, David Frum, Bill Kristol, traditional folks like that. Is this our first creation of MAGA thinkers? And is this the – some group of people have to eventually apply political science to MAGA. If it wants to live on as a concept, as a whatever it's going to turn into, eventually it has to be more than just shouting USA, USA, MAGA, MAGA, MAGA. There has to be some intellectual beef put behind it. This is what looks like the first attempt maybe to formulate a group of people that are going to try to add some traditional policy and political thinking to the whole America First strategy.
I think that is the intent here. And the question, though, is even with that, how successful is that going to be without Trump on the ballot, right?
It's not.
Right, because most of Trump's support is not based on any idea. It's on the feelings and emotions that he creates in his supporters. And so I don't know that any of these people can directly replicate without having Trump there side by side on the ballot, and have his coattails. So, you know, if he doesn't run in 2024, does this continue? Does it just fall apart? Is it able to be maintained by this group of so-called leaders? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I don't know that any of them have the ability that Trump has and the charisma that he exuded with his followers to carry them on.
But they're trying.
They're trying.
Well, and if it goes beyond headline grabbing attention, then maybe we'll see some sort of depth of political analysis or some, you know, what's the next step of this, right? And that's unclear with these folks right now. It's just they got on Fox News for the next round.
I think that was what their objective was. But what fascinates me is, are people going to try to actually put some intellectual meat on the Keep America First political strategy bone? And can that be done? Because you would only do that is if you wanted this movement to live outside of Trump. It just can't be his personality that propels it together.
You say that, but it's gone off of emotion quite well so far.
That's what I'm saying. When Trump's gone, you've got to have some other mechanism.
Yeah, I would argue Trump is kind of a singular force, and that without having him, you know, you don't have that same ability to create what he created.
So now it's almost like within the system, the MAGA people are trying to build within the
a platform,
a platform to push this forward, minus Trump.
And also separate themselves out from the rest of the Republican Party and say, this is us and this is the MAGA legacy. And, you know, because I think that they have to do that and separate themselves from the party in some way, because that's what Trump did.
And Brandon, why I'm so afraid of this is Trump failed because he's an idiot. These people will fail because they're all idiots. You add 50 points to these people in IQ, shit's going to start getting scary.
I mean, think if you have someone like a Josh Hawley who takes up this cause in the Senate and creates the America First Caucus in the Senate, because this is a House caucus. So Josh Hawley is cunning and smart and, you know, devious. And what we, I think, have said all along is, you know, we just have to wait for the next Trump who has, you know, a pedigree education and who has the intelligence to really take it to the next level and use that to manipulate. Because, you know, Trump's undoing was that he couldn't stay focused and that he was all over the place.
Brandon, isn't that Ron DeSantis? Isn't Ron DeSantis Trump with a Harvard education and about 50 to 60 IQ points?
He's apparently the heir apparent to Trump.
Wow.
Yeah.
Birth of a dictator then with that mix.
We're so afraid of him. We just did a complete hit job smear on him on 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
Which
backfired, actually. Well, yeah.
Because the premise is so stupid.
Right.
Basically, they said the smoking gun of Ron DeSantis's corruption around COVID in Florida was that he took a $100,000 bribe or $100,000 donation to his PAC from Publix to let them distribute the COVID vaccine. Well, that's ignorant on multiple levels. Number one, $100,000 is nothing in modern politics. Number two, Publix is the biggest grocery store chain in Florida. Yeah. They have more pharmacies than anybody. They are the natural distribution arm for the state of Florida. So DeSantis must be coming up, or he must be hitting people's radar enough that the media feels they've got to do a hack job.
Well, that was such a stupid attack because there's plenty to attack DeSantis on. I mean, you could have gone after the fact that, you know, COVID vaccinations were originally made available to these very Tony gated communities that where most of his donors lived. I mean, you could have attacked him for the way they hid infection numbers initially in the pandemic and kind of messed with the numbers. There was a lot of other avenues of attack, and that was a ridiculous one. And he ended up looking good coming out of it, and it just improved his standing among his supporters and among those who weren't necessarily his supporters. So it completely backfired, and he's come out of it in better shape than he politically.
Now, I think if you strip away, now that Trump's out of the political picture, if you rub all of the orange dye off what he left behind and just peel back all the layers of just absolute asinineness, is there enough there that people can actually form a party and create a movement? Well, that's going to be really
ticking,
interesting,
right?
Yeah, and the clock's ticking.
You've got 2 years now to figure that out.
That's a great point. This has a shelf life. If you can't pull this off by 2024, you don't pull it off.
And you could even argue it's shorter if you want to include the redistricting efforts.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's coming up quickly and state legislators.
If a smarter group of people in Congress would have grabbed a hold of this idea, this may have some legs. I think this fails just because the people involved are just straight up idiots. I mean, Gates may go to jail. Gohmert's die. They're just fools. But if this idea takes root and a better group of people gets a hold of it, can MAGA keep America whatever first agenda? Does this have any ability to grow into something that maybe let's take the Tea Party as the last time somebody tried to caucus under a single kind of idea or entity. Can this be as successful as the Tea Party? The Tea Party's still around in Congress.
That's true. Yeah, it's although the Tea Party has fizzled out, I mean, quite a bit.
But what's the remnant of the Tea Party? Because that's the Mark Meadows crowd and all of that people, isn't it?
I mean, somewhat. The House conservative study group. I mean, the Tea Party itself, though, I mean, as a fundraising arm and apparatus for electing candidates is no more, but there is remnants of it that are still out there and powerful. But yeah, I agree. I think the question, this is being widely panned because the people behind it are so dumb and they made their intentions so clear. They forgot that part about that you're supposed to dog whistle. You're not supposed to just, you know, come out and say what you
say
actually mean.
Don't say the quiet part out loud.
So I think that's going to be their undoing. But this could be picked up later by somebody else. And so the question is who and how successful would it be?
Well, this nativism thread is not going away.
No, that's a thread.
Amount of people who are
right.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the right way to say it. Who's going to start pulling on this thread in a way more artful way than Trump did?
Yeah, and I would even look to, you know, you had a vote on the hate crimes legislation this week in the Senate. You know, to respond to the rash of hate crimes against Asian Americans. There were six senators who voted against that. They overlap with the six senators who voted as part of the Sedition Caucus to not verify the election results back in January.
Let's see if we can guess them, Jason. Rand Paul.
Yeah.
Green. Oh, she's House. Yeah. Never mind.
Okay, so
these are Sanders.
Okay, Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell.
Not Mitch McConnell. So remember, this is – so the initial vote not to ratify the election results.
Okay.
So think about the senators Ted Cruz.
Cruz. Oh,
Josh Hawley. Okay. Roger Marshall.
I gotcha.
Yeah. Is that four? I think we're leaving out two. But, you know, so the usual – it's basically every senator that voted against – because it was this – it's really the same six that voted at the very end after the Capitol was attacked to still not certify the election were the ones who voted against this legislation. And, you know, they all gave their own reasoning for doing so. But I think you can look to those senators as the ones who would most likely be form the America First caucus in the Senate.
How could we forget Cruz?
By the way, he raised $5.1 million in Q1. So Hawley raised over three.
I know he raised over three too.
They're
yeah.
Not, those
they're not
folks.
Being heard at all. Yeah.
I mean,
they're
going away
anytime
soon.
They're not going anywhere. Ugh. So is there any – so this we don't think this caucus is going to succeed. We think this is, a branding exercise for these folks. It may be just an overture to Trump, and that's
money-making, publicity.
Money-making.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to come around to the idea that while insurrection was never the ultimate goal on the 6th, the Republicans have a – They flirted with the idea, and now they are accepting of the idea that they can open up a third front to gain political power, and that is fighting presidential elections in state legislators. Jason, yeah. I come to this conclusion because nobody has really come out other than a very small handful of people and tried to excise Trump from the party. People, big Republican donors, are still going to Mar-a-Lago to hear the 90-minute stump speech that starts – is in the middle and
still celebrated all the RNC conventions.
Absolutely. And, yeah. So are we basically saying that we think the Republicans are legitimately going to open up a third area to fight for power? And that is through the courts about the presidency based on election law.
We've spoken often about looking for a more moderate voice or a, you know, adult in the room voice to come forward and squash this, and it hasn't happened anytime in the last 4 years. It's not going to anytime soon. So the question is, does this set take over the Republican Party permanently? And maybe that's their goal instead of trying to split off and create something new. It is somewhat strange to me to think of it starting with a caucus when they already have so much momentum behind taking over the entire party, from a political advantage or from a, recruitment advantage.
Yeah.
Why start there if you've already got so much momentum behind you from the larger side?
True. And I think what's being missed in all this is there's a lot of attention being paid on the federal level and I guess somewhat on the state level with the state legislatures that are passing all these election reform bills. But I think what's often overlooked, we've mentioned the power the Georgia state legislature has as part of that reform and being able to circumvent local election laws. But also what's happening at the state party level in all these states. So the purging of officials who upheld their duties. I think all of us remember back in Michigan during the canvassing, you had the Wayne County, where Detroit is located, the Wayne County Canvassing Board that originally voted to certify the election results. And then they were pressured. They got phone calls from Trump and the Republicans changed their vote. Well, you had the one person on the canvassing board who was an aide to a state lawmaker, Republican traditional, who voted to certify those election results. He's been yanked now from that canvassing board. He was the one vote to ensure that the election results were upheld. You have other instances like in Nevada earlier this week where the local party censored the Secretary of State simply for saying the election was fair and free and there weren't any issues. She upheld her job. Notably, she's the only statewide elected Republican in Nevada. So you would think Nevada Republicans would say, hey, what are you doing right that we can emulate? Instead, they're saying, hey, you're wrong and we're going to censor you. And by the way, you're the only person who can win in the state. Go figure. So you have this taking place across the country. And there's other Republican members of canvassing boards and local authorities who are being censored or just stripped and removed from those committees so they can be replaced with crazy people. And so the next time this happens, we might not have that one vote also key to remember, Arizona, their state legislature came within one vote of holding the Maricopa County Board of Elections in contempt, which would have meant that they would have had the authority to arrest them for not giving them the information that they wanted on the election. These are instances where you have the Republican Party at the state level that is coming very close to just taking over elections completely and acting autocratically. And I think that that has not been covered like it should. It's been very much under the radar, but it's very scary.
Yeah.
Which is almost doubling down on the point I was failing to try to make earlier, which is that you've got this working from both ends. You've got clear examples at the federal level of this massive influence from what we thought was a subset of the party, and now it's also happening at the local level.
Right, at the state level.
At some point, it meets in the middle, and they've taken over, and this is what Republicanism is now.
That what you just said, Brandon, just scared the living shit out of me sitting here listening to you say that, because that to me is stage two of the plan is in effect. Which is we fire the people who held up the last time,
yeah.
Change the rules and the law to make sure that if we have to go this route again, we have the infrastructure in place to do so.
And you have the people that will 100% yeah. support it and won't think twice about
it. That's straight yeah. out of Stalin's playbook at the yeah. Soviet Union. The other thing too is that the leader who started this idea that American elections are not safe – I think we can all agree that's metastasized across the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like 80% of Republicans yeah. believe the election was stolen.
Right.
So step one was to get everybody to question the results and to go about it in a way that described the process as so complicated, the results can never be explained. So once that gets into the bloodstream and into the body politic, now step two is eliminate the folks who stopped it the last time, replace those with your own people. And step three is change the law to give those people the ability to take the action.
This is a chapter in a history book. This has been done before.
Yeah,
right?
Literally, I mean, this has literally been done.
We've seen
hundreds
it.
Of times. Now, I don't know if it. I don't know what the end game of this is going to be, but you can certainly look at all the facts and evidence of the Republican Party and say, yeah, they're opening up a third front to fight for political power through the state houses.
Completely, and once they purge the party of all of the. You know, moderate, the reasonable voices and those who were moderating influences. I mean, that basically leaves you with one party that's committed to American democracy as we know it and one that isn't. And that doesn't afford any opportunity for the other party, the Democrats, to lose at any level. And that's not healthy or sustainable. We need to have two parties that are both committed to democratic precepts. I mean, we cannot afford to have one that isn't because that's not something you can survive from.
Yeah.
It does make you wonder what the end game is, because you've got these larger than life personalities who clearly are on for the next news cycle, but then you've got this concerted effort to change the rules to provide additional power and to prolongate their power. So if that's captured and say it lasts for 10 years and they're in positions in all forms of government from top to bottom, what's the legislation that occurs? What's the part that changes? What is the goal besides, you know,
power?
Power for power's goal. It's also a way for them to get past the demographics question, because they know demographics are working against them. So the only opportunity is to add autocratic elements to the system to maintain power for as long as possible.
But somebody wants to do something with that power, right? And that doesn't seem clearly articulated.
Keep power. Status quo. I mean, when you have a country that's changing demographically and you have the power of the potential for legislation that reflects those changing mores and values by society, then that's a threat. And so it's status quo.
What's that?
That was the strategy behind the Supreme Court and the courts and getting all of Trump's appointments through as quickly as possible.
What's that thing with like it sits on a – it sits on like a pyramid and it tips to both sides. It's got like water or some gel in it that makes little waves. And it tips back and forth.
Oh, like a scale?
Yeah, you know, I've already blown this analogy because I can't describe it. I've been thinking about it all week.
Yeah.
Say this.
Yeah, yeah,
so I could sound like super smart. I've already screwed the pooch on it. But it used to be, I think, in American politics that the idea was to keep as center as possible,
sure,
and
right,
keep the waves as small as they can. Because the wave starts at the center, it goes all the way out to the edges, bounces off the wall, gets bigger, then it heads back the other way, destroying everything in its path until there's a reaction to this wave on the other side. It grows bigger, yep, hits the wall harder, and drives us down.
Well, that's good. We've all got an image in our head now, and I can see it's getting worse, and it goes faster, right?
And Trump was that person who said, I want the biggest waves possible. I'm not here to make small waves. And now we're dealing with how that grew through the Republican Party, reached out to the far ends of the party, had an outsized impact on that. And then the reaction, just like Trump was a reaction, is Biden, who's now is creating his own waves on the other side.
Equal and opposite reaction.
My point is, it used to be we need to keep the country as little waves as we possible on the center of that, functioning as best we can. And now it's we don't like that center. Maybe that wasn't even the center the whole time. And waves are a good thing and waves need to happen. And I don't – for the Republicans, I agree with you, Brandon. I think they're running the tally of the demographics that are changing. The female vote is problematic. The suburb vote. Everything is working against them. Maybe this is the easiest way to retain power, is what Trump laid the groundwork for.
Is there an architect? Is there a plan? Is this step four of 20, or is it just how this is coming together because people want power?
You mentioned the history. This is where history comes into play. That's the person we're missing.
Yeah.
If the right architect shows up, who knows
when? And that's what makes this all dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, we're really just waiting for that super intelligent, cunning, Machiavellian personality to show up who can do what Trump couldn't get done.
Josh Hawley thinks it's him. It's not. Yeah. It's not. But Josh Hawley shows people are out there, to your point, Brandon, they're poking around. Well, what if I did this? What would it do? They're looking for that right combination to find to occupy that spot. And I just feel like America's in the spot that if that person emerges, look out, that person could do some serious damage.
Yeah. And by that time, we may not have the political constraints to keep that person from doing what we were able to keep Trump from doing. I mean, we've argued all along that we have the built-in government institutional constraints, and those upheld barely, but they were upheld in 2020. But again, those constraints rely on people and people, basically saying that we believe in this. And many of those people on those canvassing boards and in these bodies have been replaced. And so that's all you have to do. And I think the Republican Party realizes that you just replace those people with firebrands who are, core believers. And, those institutional constraints go out the window because at the end of the day, too many of them depend on people. And this goes back to what we've talked about, Craig. Those constraints really need to be enshrined in law. Right now, it's basically tradition. And it's just basically, depending on those people to uphold their oaths. And as long as that's the case, I mean, we're always one step away.
I go back to the only good line in Star Wars from after the first three movies. Isn't it, who's it, Padme, when she's like on the floor of the
Senate?
Padme
Amidala.
Yeah. And the Emperor takes over and she has the line, "This is how liberty dies," to applause.
Thunderous applause, yeah.
That's how it happens in the United States.
Yeah.
It won't be a war. It won't be a conflict. Liberty will die to thunderous applause. And I don't think we are not guaranteed that that's our fate, but we are running as close up to it, I think, as I've ever seen us.
Craig's right. Applying historical lessons to Star Wars when he was ranting on it last week.
Awesome.
You guys got to start this Revolutions podcast. I've been neck deep into this thing for like a month and a half. I sent the guy, Mike Duncan, an email the other day. I'm fascinated with this podcast.
I just started the very first one, which is on English.
Yes.
The Revolution.
You go English, yeah. American, French.
Right.
I just got through the French, which is 56 episodes.
Wow. See, I
was going to say there's a ton of episodes.
Too much.
We just ended on Napoleon.
Oh, okay.
And it's just absolutely fantastic.
So how often are episodes cranked out? Like, what's
so
the
he
frequency?
Does them once a week, but okay. He's done 10 seasons.
Wow.
So he's done hundreds and hundreds of episodes.
I'm never
going to
catch up. Oh, my God.
But it is amazing as you listen to this how much of this parallels today.
Yeah.
And you just want to, like, yell at everybody. We need to start reading more books, and we need to start reading more history.
Is he speaking extemporaneously, or is he is he writing something that he's then, you know, researching and
he writes a 30 to 40 minute episode and just reads it.
Okay.
And so my wife is like, so every night when you go for a walk, you get so excited to put your headphones on to listen to another man read to you for 45 minutes. I'm like, okay, yeah, it sounds bad when you say it that way, but yeah, it has no production value to it. It's just him. And it is amazing. It's just fascinating. And there's so many parallels between then and now, because revolutions are all about political change, quest for power. It's about how power is allocated and how power is taken from one group and given to another.
So the amount of this is intimidating. If somebody wants to come in at a certain spot, is there, you know, you just mentioned Americans, French, and whatever. Is there one that you would recommend?
You really have to choose your revolution,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, just choose
your revolution. That sounds like that should be like a game or something.
Just start with the American Revolution, because you'll have some context for it. You know kind of the four corners. Sure. You know the characters. It's only like 15 or 20 episodes, because the American Revolution really didn't compare to some of the other big revolutions that happened over in Europe.
Right.
And the greatest thing you learn about the American Revolution is there's a letter from Cornwallis who just says, I've won every battle I've fought with these people. I beat them in battle. I own all the military locations of any strategic value. I own everything. These people just won't quit. And this was every general the British sent over basically reported back. I just keep beating them on the battlefield. I just keep taking their land and positions, and they just keep showing up again. What do you want me to do with these people? So it's amazing that our history is started by, we just didn't know when to give up.
American persistence.
That's right.
Puritan work ethic.
And Washington's main strategy is, okay, guys, try not to all get killed today. Our only strategy is don't get wiped out in one big battle, because eventually, just like Afghanistan, if we keep them here long enough, right, they're going to lose interest.
And was it that, and maybe you could, this is probably maybe talked about on the podcast, Craig, but was it that the story of the American Revolution, the British constantly undermined Americans? Oh. I mean, they looked at us as these colonials, like dumb colonials on
this,
like,
what are these people doing? These are farmers.
Right.
It's like, we're the greatest army in the world. We will stand in a line and let you shoot us all day long and won't move. We have artillery, we have cavalry, we have people who this is their third or fourth generation in the military, and these farmers just won't stop fighting. And that's what's so fascinating about the American Revolution. And some of the problems that we talk about today are built out of that rugged individualism and that mythology of, well, we just don't give up, and if you're just persistent, you're going to get your way. And yeah, there's times when that's true. There's also times you just get smashed, and that's the
way it goes. And you have to recognize reality, yeah.
And you have to recognize reality. I think this gets back to what we talked about with Afghanistan. We just are recognizing the reality. I'm sorry I took us all off on another revolutions thing.
No, that was interesting.
Yeah. If you really – season 10 is the Russian Revolution, and that's kind of the longest one, because that's the biggie. But that's another one he hasn't finished yet, but that one that one's pretty good too.
Oh, yeah, that'd be an interesting one.
This guy's prolific every single week.
This dude
– wow.
I mean, I feel lazy and stupid when listening to this guy, because one, he does this every week. He's written two books during this podcast, and he's had two kids.
Wow.
So it's like, dude, he lived in France for 3 years when he was researching the French Revolution and writing a book about Lafayette. So, yeah, this guy's intellectual capacity is – I'm not going to throw you two in the mix, but it's way, way bigger than mine could ever be.
Yeah, talk about making us feel inadequate, right? Yeah.
I mean
I'm glad people like that exist and spend their time educating the rest of us.
And he chose the absolute greatest format to do this in – a podcast.
Yeah.
And that's what my wife never understands, why podcasting is so neat. I have this group of friends that exist on my phone that I talk to every single week, and I listen to their conversations. You develop a relationship with these people and the story that they're telling over time that's very enjoyable.
Amen.
That's agreed. The stick to my wife who does like hates podcasting and thinks everything's stupid.
You'll hear from her after this podcast.
Brandon, she does not listen to any of these podcasts. As she said, you run your mouth here all the time. I've already heard it. Why would I want to listen to it?
She gets a nightly dose at dinner. Yeah.
What really, really makes me happy is when one of her friends will tell her, I just want you to tell your husband that I've listened to all of his podcasts and I think they're great. And it's like, ha, ha, ha. Now that I've gloated about my wife, we wanted to wrap up talking about police violence and policing. Yeah.
So again, in the news, we have more examples of police violence, shootings all caught on camera. We have the U.S. Army Ranger who was pulled over, had guns drawn on him. And we had that police officer who was fired from that police force.
Have you seen that video with Adam Toledo in Chicago, if I'm saying that right?
The 13-year-old?
Yeah, the 13-year-old.
I have not yet. Okay. But I've heard it's extremely difficult to watch.
Is that the body cam footage?
Yeah, but he has a gun behind him that he's raising his hand above his head, but he has a gun behind him, and he drops the gun, then lifts his hands. Yes, the kid shouldn't have been shot, but what do you want that cop to do? He has a gun. Yeah. It's 3 a.m.
Yes.
He's been chasing it through an alley. What?
Yeah.
And that is different, yeah, because he did have a gun, unlike some of these other stories that are circulating right now with officers. I think the most egregious one was obviously the female police officer that pulled out.
She was going to tase him or something.
Apparently.
A stun gun.
But I have difficulty believing that just because I've heard from other officers directly
saying
that you can tell, they weigh different. It's ingrained in you to know which one is which. And other officers said that mistake is not made.
And even with Jason, you made the fake pull the gun. You used your prominent hand, right?
Yeah.
That's the side your gun's always on. So you always know I'm in my right hand or my left hand.
Right. I guess a good thing out of that is that those charges against her came swiftly. Like there wasn't a delay, because what we've seen in the past often is that there's this delay in bringing charges when it comes, to many of these cases. And so there's a feeling that those charges only come because of the outcry and the uproar that occurs. But yeah, so we have all of that. And then, of course, a Derek Chauvin trial going on right now. So I think it creates this very combustible atmosphere with what we have. It is interesting to see, though, that this is still an issue, and there hasn't been any resolution legislatively. It's been interesting to see you've had some police departments that have responded to this, saying they're putting in new rules of and protocol in terms of how officers, when it comes to having a taser versus not and holding them accountable. So you have like a patchwork of local level things that are happening, but there, it gets back to the problem that policing is on the local level. Like there isn't anything that's centralized that governs police officers.
We need to talk to a police officer, because I would love to ask the question, do you ever just walk away? Do you ever just say, you know what, you seem pretty agitated. You've got a couple minor arrest warrants for you. You know what? We'll just catch you later.
I don't understand. And I hate to compare, but there are these circumstances that it seem like so egregious. And then you compare to, we had a state senator in Kansas, for people that didn't follow that story, who was driving drunk the wrong way on I-70, nearly killed several people, fled from police officers for several minutes and evaded them, was finally pulled over, called the police officer names, threatened to fight him. He did not have a gun pulled on him or drawn on him. He was not roughed up in any manner.
You see restraint in a lot of cases, too.
Yeah, and so it's like, how does that happen with that guy? And then you have, the Army guy, who, has guns drawn on him. And so you look at those cases, and you it does make you wonder why there's this unequal treatment in many cases.
One of the things I identified before last year when some of this topic came up was how much a police officer is asked to do outside of policing, cases where people have mental issues or drug problems or, domestic issues, et cetera. Children, they get called for every kind of possible scenario that there isn't another group in the city or state to handle. And so I totally respect that. And I imagine how challenging that is. Then the counterpoint is like, don't be out at 3 in the morning. Nothing good happens after midnight, my parents used to say. But don't be out at 3 in the morning. Don't be out at 3 in the morning with a gun.
Seems straightforward.
Yeah. It's hard to be critical of a police officer being at heightened level of awareness at 3 a.m. in the dark, chasing after somebody has a gun.
Roll out of your car at 3 a.m. Chase a 13-year-old through some alleys, and the odds of that ending poorly go up significantly. Yeah. What I was thinking is, I've never lived in a community that the community didn't set the rules for policing. So, for example, I live in Platte City up north. If the cops got extra energetic one day and started pulling kids out of cars, putting them up against the car, frisking, it'd take about 3 calls from parents and that shit would stop, because the community simply is not going to tolerate that from the police.
Yeah.
Isn't part of the problem in what predominantly African-American communities are saying, we are not involved in setting the parameters for how we are policed like a white community is.
Well, and that's true. And a lot of the another aspect of that problem is a lot of these African-American communities, the police forces that operate in those communities don't often reflect the racial composition, right? That's been a criticism that there's few black officers on the force, and that if you had more diversity, you would change the rapport with these communities. You might change the interaction as well. So that's always been something that's been...
Or just better defined expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a small farming town. In high school, everybody ran around and drank on back roads and farted around, and the cops would come and turn their lights on and we'd all drive off. And that was it to that, because that's what the community expected. How can you get more predominantly African-American communities? Is it more people? Is it more representation on the force and government? How do they get to that same spot to say, we are going to dictate what we will accept from police?
I think that's part of it. I think it's also governing boards. A good example here locally in Shawnee, which I follow because I used to be on the Shawnee City Council, they just created an independent citizens police review board, basically to be able to look over actions of police force, high profile cases that occur in this community, be able to provide that outside perspective that often doesn't occur. I think that may be something too that would be a good just check.
Yeah.
A big part of this problem is that you have, whenever there's an incident involving a police officer, and we're talking about a small number of the overall incident profile, so it's a good thing to remember this is not the norm at all. So it's a small number, but I always tell people, even if we're talking about like 1%, it has an outsized impact because police officers are invested with so much authority. Mm. And so that's what we have to remember. Many of these cases, these police officers operate too under unions that provide them full cover. And there isn't a lot of transparency in being able to have these cases. And I think a way that you can address that is through these independent citizens review boards, particularly in African-American communities. I think those could be extremely effective if you had them working directly with the police force. Because I find it interesting, you can have, and I don't want to go deep into the Derek Chauvin case because that's, but the one thing that strikes me about that case is you had the police chief testify at trial saying this guy violated our—
Against Chauvin.
Yeah against Chauvin. Mm. I mean, and it's rare that you have a police chief testify against any of his officers, but the police union is completely backing Chauvin up. And in almost all circumstances, even with the wealth of evidence, another story that was in the news this week, the head of the police union in Boston, who's been the in charge of the police union there for, I think, over 20 years, is a alleged child molester, has basically molested all of these boys. And the police union knew about it, did it take action, basically hid it under the rug, and it's all coming to light now, and now he's been fired. And so the question is, like, why was he allowed to operate like this when all these people knew, and they just kind of shrugged? And again, it gets back to that lack of transparency and that idea that you kind of protect your own. And so there has to be some way to just have a check on that outside of the union. And that's,
so this community board you're describing sounds like that's a great answer.
Yeah, because usually those are invested with powers by the governing bodies in these communities. So the city and the mayor to be able to provide that check. And more cities are adopting those types of mechanisms.
So I'd be curious to see how that works for Shawnee and if any of the other neighboring
start to do it. Yeah, I think Shawnee may be the first community. I don't know if any others did. And you spoke of mental health. It made me think there was a local story here in Overland Park, if you guys remember the Albers case. Mm-mm. So that was the kid who had mental issues in his driveway. Police were called out. He was backing out of his driveway. They told him to stop. He did listen, and he got shot and killed. And that was a case, too, where Overland Park is under fire now because they negotiated for that officer to resign and gave him severance. And they claimed that he left of his own volition. And that wasn't the case. Yeah. Like, this was, you know, and those files were just released now because of the court case.
There's a lawsuit going on.
A lawsuit there, against the city. So there's all these other issues that come into play, too, outside of just the alleged misconduct that may occur with an officer. It's about the lack of transparency. And it all goes back to, if you can have a check on that, make more transparent at the beginning, we can uncover more and we can find the facts quicker. And so if it is an officer that's innocent, he can be exonerated much faster. Or if he's guilty, we can find that out more quickly.
What's weird is we're all fascinated with how technology is advancing, but are organizations advancing? It seems like we're stuck in this problem, and we can throw the institutional racism problem in here. There were a bunch of rules that weren't right, and we got rid of all the rules and said, this type of behavior is not allowed anymore. We've done this through all of our institutions, all the police. This is the institutional racism argument. Institutional racism as a definition doesn't exist because there is no law. It's been outlawed. It's at the federal level, the county level, every level. You cannot find a law on the books that promotes or protects racist behavior. We've gone through and we've eliminated all of that through the organization. And I think the way that we've said we'll deal with this is now on individual behavior, we will pull you out and deal with you individually. The rules of the organization have been corrected, and now how you deal with it is on an individual basis.
Unless it's a lot of individuals.
My point is, has that reached its logical conclusion? To your point, maybe the study is that didn't work as well as we thought it did because it wasn't a onesie twosie bad apple. It was, okay, you rewrote some of the rules or the organization, but all the informal rules and communications and norms, which is really how they function, you didn't impact any of those because those are all kept by the people that are there. I guess I don't have an answer, but aren't some of these things, as we've done the work on paper to say we're not allowed to or we don't want you to, but we haven't solved the problem. To your point, Brandon, how do you get this one person who has organizational power out of the way so the organization can change?
Well, and that's what's so difficult because of like union rules. Once you're a police officer, it becomes difficult to fire officers. Yeah. So really the solution to that is not hiring them in the first place or being able to root out the problem, the bad apples in the beginning. And to do that, you really need to have robust hiring practices. And it's difficult now for many police departments around the country. They can't attract the high quality, good character caliber type of people they need. And many of the people that are applying are, I don't want to generalize, but there are people that are applying who are getting through the cracks who are less than that, who are more willing to.
And protection of the institution of the police is more important than punishing the individual officer.
Right.
Not tarnishing the institution of the police takes precedent. The greatest example of this in recent history is Penn State University, who basically allowed a coach that they knew was molesting kids to do it because they didn't want to tarnish the university or the legendary coach.
And this isn't just the police problem, Kirk. This is an organizational problem. Yeah. I mean, you can, whether it's the Boy Scouts, the Catholic Church, Penn State, go on and on. There's this tendency in organizations and where it's, you find out that this bad behavior is happening and you immediately, your thoughts turn to protect the organization, cover it up, hide it,
we'll get away with it,
move the person around, which we've seen over and over again. It's the same playbook used by every single organization over and over.
Which is where that need for transparency comes in. Because Craig, to your point, the laws are on the books.
They are.
You don't need more legislation.
The rules are there.
Right and wrong has been written down repeatedly.
For a really long time, right law has been written down. This is Ben Shapiro's argument against institutional racism. Point to the law that's still on the books that allows racist behavior to continue. I don't think you could find one in the United States. But because the laws, the rules of the organization is rewritten, doesn't mean the outcome is any less different. And I think that's where – how do we close that gap? I don't know.
And I don't know how you address the hiring issues that are happening right now across the country too, because that's a real challenge. And there's an old axiom that nobody hates a bad cop worse than a good cop, right? Because, you know, they have to work with them. And I think I've told this story before, but I'll never forget back when I was on the council, I invited a Shawnee police officer to speak in my HOA meeting to talk about, like, you know, burglaries in the neighborhood and what you can do to be safe. So I was chatting with him after the meeting, and I said, hey, you know, how's the hiring process go? Because we had approved budget for hiring 5 new police officers. And he's like, well, it's not going well. Hmm. He's like, we haven't been able to hire anybody for months. And part of the problem is we're attracting a lot of candidates, but these are people you would not want anywhere near the force. I mean, these are people that have horrible histories that are all focused on when they can fire a weapon. And like they failed their psychological tests. And he's like, but I'm just shocked that we're getting these people who are applying in the first place. But he's like, what keeps me up at night is the fact that, not that we reject them because our standards are so high, and that's why we haven't been able to hire anybody yet. But what about some another police department in a small town that is desperate because they don't have the police presence they need, and they're willing to cut corners and say, okay, we'll give this person a chance.
Or they don't have the technology or the knowledge base to know that these people were rejected somewhere else. Or maybe they were fired off of the force somewhere across the country.
And that's
a
problem, too, is that the information is shared. There isn't a national database where this information is accessible. So somebody could go to another PD in a tiny town that wouldn't have access to this, and it's like a blank slate.
I've got
and they
10 years of experience. You're hired.
Yeah.
We're getting a little long on time.
It is.
So, Jason, are you like reading, looking, watching, listening to anything that is providing enjoyment to you right now?
Just started a new show that, I'm reluctant to pass it on since I'm not very far in, but what the heck? We just got Yellowstone.
I've heard good things about
Costner. Yellowstone is fantastic.
Yeah, and we got it at the library if anybody wants it easy and free. And it's really good so far, yeah.
So I think there's 3 seasons of Yellowstone. It gets progressively better and much more violent throughout the thing. By season 3, if your kids are watching it, there's going to be some... Let me add some context to you for that quote. But it is fantastic.
It gives you a different view of, you know, being around here in the suburbs and you see the Montana wilderness and rancher style.
I didn't know Montana was such a violent place. But the real star of the show, I think her name is like Kelly Reich, the one main Dutton daughter.
Mm.
She is a force in that show. She is very enjoyable to watch.
Well, and there's a lot of this cultural class struggle stuff too, between people who want things to stay the way they were, and then there's the modern civilization encroaching on it, and then you have the Native American component of it's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's
landownership is kind of the central theme there, which is good. What about you, Brandon? Brandon, you brought in a whole notepad of notes, and I didn't see you look at them once.
Our topics don't really fit that, so we could talk about that.
He was well prepared for a very different conversation.
This happens all the time. Let's just take that and throw that in the trash.
Yeah, no, it's good. It was just on some of the changes with like party identification and how like polarization. There's some new numbers that came out that we can talk about on another podcast. But let's see what I've seen recently. I saw the movie Nobody recently.
Is that good?
That was pretty good. It's kind of what's the campy? But good and cheesy, but in a fun way. Like, you know, just it, there's it's
I
not
don't know what
realistic.
This is again. So context, what nobody who's in it? What is it?
Yeah. So the guy that's in this was in
Better Call
Better
Saul.
Better Call Saul. Yes.
Okay.
Breaking Bad.
Bob
Breaking
Odenkirk.
Bad.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Jason there.
Nice.
With the,
you on it. So he plays this like suburban dad who basically has background that his family doesn't know about. Is like a fixer who gets called in. He's like an accountant for all of the.
By the way, Brandon, this is every middle-aged guy's fantasy in suburbia right now. Yeah,
the fixer.
Yeah,
just like I'm like some super agent, way tougher than I actually am personally.
Right. Yeah. So he basically does the books for like CIA, FBI, like all the alphabet agencies. And then he goes to make people disappear that they need to disappear. His family, his kids don't know this, though. And so they think he's kind of the lame, kind of boring dad who has a boring job. And all they know is that he does have a military background, special forces. And so it's about Russian operatives who are the son of which is gets shot by him on a bus when they're causing trouble. And then this Russian kingpin comes after him and he has all these connections and he has to fight them off. And it's campy and cheesy and unrealistic, but it's fun.
It's another one I'd probably be interested in seeing.
A lot of action.
Is it the theater? Did you go to the theater?
It's at the theater. Yep, yeah. I saw the theater, yeah.
So, I mean, if I was a fixer or cleaner for the CIA, my kids would definitely know it because I want my kids to know.
Over the dinner table, guess what I did today?
Yeah, guess what I did? And I can do it to you whenever I want.
One of the craziest scenes in this movie is like when his house is attacked at night and he quickly gets all his family into the basement, locks the door, and then he takes out each of these like Russian guys one by one and then opens the door and the family comes up from the basement and there's like blood all over the walls. There's dead bodies littered on the sofa and all over.
And how does he explain
the house
that away?
In the kitchen. And
so it's kind of like John Wick with a family.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey, they made three of those.
I've been watching the Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yeah. I just started that.
It's really surprisingly good.
Is it?
I had no expectations
on this.
Did
you watch WandaVision too?
I did not. I got to watch that.
That was good. That was really good.
But once again, the Marvel small screen stuff has been very, very
Disney
good.
Disney has been amazing with that. Yeah, I've been very impressed.
Yes. As DC just wallers around trying to get any traction anywhere. They just cannot figure it out.
What's the next DC? Actually, I saw a trailer at the theater for the next DC one, Suicide Squad movie coming out. Yeah.
But if you're a DC fan, that's not what you want.
No,
Suicide Squad is a secondary.
Yeah.
Suicide Squad is Guardians of the Galaxy in the Marvel. It's good, but it's not the main thing.
I don't understand
the strategy.
Where's
Batman and Superman?
Yeah, where's
the strategy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's the 20 film arc like Marvel put together
for
that? So
it's not there.
I don't know. All right, we're getting a little long. We should call it there. All right, bye guys.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.